So, as Deborah said, my name is Holly Groom. I work as a research analyst at the Oregon Immunization Program. And the talk, I actually changed the title slightly. It's Evaluating Local Efforts to Provide Equitable Access to 2009 H1N1 Vaccine. I changed it from assure to provide because we can't really assure, but we can only try. So here you can see a graphic representation of waves 1 and 2 based on lab-confirmed influenza hospitalizations. And so the way Oregon decided to do it was to give local agencies the responsibility of distributing vaccine to the populations within their care. And by local agencies, I mean mostly county health departments, but also tribal agencies and health facilities and state institutional facilities. But obviously, along with the local agencies, the state worked very hard to come up with estimates of prioritization groups and do allocation of vaccine, and then to facilitate the ordering and distribution processes that occurred. So the five of us that worked on this project, we sat down in early December and tried to come up with an idea of, well, what else would we like to know about what's going on at the agency level? And we came up with these three study objectives, which were to understand local agencies' initial H1N1 vaccination plans for priority groups, but also for underserved populations, because we wanted to find out how it was they were going to reach out to the groups that were vulnerable, that were not included in the priority groups. And then to come up to identify some of the implementation strategies that they came up with and their related barriers, and come up with some recommendations for improvements in future response scenarios. So we came up with an interview guide that we used as a semi-structured guide for our telephone interviews. And we did all of this in January 2010. And as a point of time reference, the priority groups were in effect in Oregon up until December 13th, at which point it opened up to everybody. So we decided to postpone a little bit post that opening up and get through the holidays, and started out in January and conducted all of our interviews with people. And we focused specifically on immunization coordinators, H1N1 coordinators, and where possible, we got public health emergency preparedness coordinators to participate in the interviews. And they lasted about 45 minutes each. We covered a lot of topics, and I'm not going to present all of the information that we gathered from these interviews, but just focus specifically planning and strategies for implementation. We had an 85% response rate, which we thought was really good, and the people that didn't respond or participate were probably just still too busy responding to H1N1. As a point of clarification, underserved populations, I just wanted to spell out exactly what I mean by that, and this is a list that came out of the Office of the Associate Secretary for Preparedness Response, and they include transient populations, non-English speakers, individuals with transportation barriers, individuals living in institutionalized settings, individuals with chronic medical disorders, individuals with disabilities, children and youth with special health care needs, individuals from diverse cultures, and pregnant women. And the three groups that are in bold are those that overlap with priority groups, not to suggest that these other groups don't also, but those are the clear overlaps. So when we sat down and decided what it is we wanted to talk about with the local agencies, the first thing was about planning. And we wanted to know, we had a conversation with them about what exactly they had put in place prior to actually implementing their vaccination strategies. And one of the requirements had been that agencies come up with updated mass vax plans. As H1N1 came along the horizon, they were asked to update them and to spell out specifically how they intended to reach their priority groups and their underserved groups. And as we reviewed those plans prior to having these conversations with them, it was apparent that people really had expected to use community and school-based pods, points of dispersion clinics, or mass vax clinics. It's what they had known from doing seasonal influenza from past years, from preparedness response activities, and they felt pretty equipped to do that. And that's the details about what they intended to do were very much focused on these community clinics. So the clear issue with that came into play was that these plans were developed based on assumptions of adequate supply of vaccine. People assumed that they could build on their experience with schools in past years and actually disseminate vaccine to a wide audience. And in fact, the vaccine came in slowly, as we all know. And so pods were no longer an appropriate mode of delivery. And for a lot of people, that was very discouraging and difficult because they suddenly had to come up with new strategies for getting vaccine out the door. And I'm sure this is familiar to a lot of people in the room. And I think a difficult relationship issue with schools, and that parents and school partners felt that their kids were going to get vaccinated in a school setting. And for those that chose to postpone their school clinics till later on until they had enough vaccine to do all schools, that became a difficulty for some people. So then we asked the question about how, in fact, did you get vaccine out, and what did you do to do it? And again, these are going to be activities that are familiar to a lot of people here, but I think it's important to highlight them nonetheless. And I think some of the common themes that came out were subprioritization for healthcare workers, pregnant women, and children with special needs. People enrolled, pediatricians, OBGYN, and hospitals, and they got vaccine out to emergency services personnel as best they could. And those were the clear, quick strategies that they had. And a little bit later on, or sometimes in conjunction with that, people would have local health departments create appointment scheduled clinics with appointment only. And then for some places, they continued to do schools in select locations if they had enough vaccine to do so. Some of the specific examples of things people did that we felt were important to highlight here were getting some vaccine to schools. If you weren't going to do a full mass clinic, then they would get enough vaccine out for the high-risk kids at the school and have the school nurses reach out to those kids. There was a really strong relationship with Babies First and Cocoon, they have nurses on board and they did home visits for kids with special needs and vaccinated their families as well. The specialized clinics that people targeted were those with dialysis or cancer clinics. And then a couple interesting ideas that came from tribal agency were knock and greet, where they went door to door and actually told people about the vaccination clinics they were holding, and then bringing clinics into casino settings to get the vaccine to the public. A couple agencies had providers that used reminder notices, sending them out to homes to let people know. And a couple people detailed out how they had actually used H1N1 vaccination as an opportunity to screen for other vaccines that were needed for both children and for adults. So the barriers that came up, and I'm going to switch the order of these slightly and start with the second bullet, which has to do with the fact that the first presentation that people saw or had widely available was the live attenuated vaccine. And this was an issue on two levels, the first being that for some of the priority groups, this was not the appropriate vaccine to use. And on the second level, there was a lot of resistance apparently among healthcare worker and emergency services personnel to getting the live attenuated vaccine. And people voiced specifically that they wanted to wait until the inactivated presentation became available. So those were two clear themes that came out. And then most of the other issues, the other three bullets there had to do with prioritization. So the fact that what we had going on is we have denser county areas that service larger populations. By November, they were still barely reaching out to their priority groups. They were struggling to try to get vaccine out to the door to those people. Where we had smaller counties who in fact had smaller populations and had reached a lot of their priority groups by November and were waiting for those prioritizations to open up so that they could provide vaccine to the larger public. And I think there was this disconnect between the status and being able to, the scope of activities that you were able to implement based on the timing of those prioritizations was a big issue. There was also the issue that it was difficult to share vaccine across county lines. So one agency had said, since I wasn't able to open up to the public and I had largely reached my priority groups, I would have liked to have provided vaccine to another county that was still trying to reach those priority groups, but it wasn't easily done or able to do, and it would have been helpful if we had a process to facilitate that transfer. And then just the fact that vaccination could have opened up much earlier for many of the agencies. So now I want to talk a little bit about underserved populations, and because there's so many groups that we use include in the category of underserved, I put it in a table format. So the left column is obviously the population, and then the activities on the right are the ways that people reach them. And so for the transient population, obviously they brought vaccine to shelters and soup kitchens, but one place had actually figured out that most of their transient populations sought care at a VA medical center, and they brought vaccine there. Non-English speakers, largely through WIC and safety net clinics, and Latina health navigators. A lot of media messaging that occurred in Spanish, and that was the dominant language where you saw alternate materials coming out that people felt were very helpful to have. Transportation barriers, people that had those had some examples of home vaccination and then transportation, bringing people into clinics. Institutionalized settings covers a sort of a broad range of types of people. There were long-term care facilities, but there's also detention centers or juvenile detention centers and foster home settings. And again, people would contract nurses out and get vaccine out to those long-term care facilities as well as detention centers and jails. I already covered a little bit chronic medical disorders for the specialized clinics, and then disability population, and I'll get on this a little bit later with as far as a barrier, but there was some coordination with seniors and people with disabilities, a group, and visits to group homes. Again, the children with special needs were serviced largely by Babies First and Cocoon, who provided, again, nursing in home settings. The diverse cultures encompasses a lot of different types of people, but a lot of the areas where we saw vaccine being offered in churches. There were some media messaging specifically for Asian communities that occurred. And then knock and greet, as I mentioned earlier, in casinos would be some non-traditional settings that we saw vaccine being brought to. And then again, pregnant women who were a priority group, the safety net clinics, WIC and FQHCs. some of the barriers that came into play with vaccinating the underserved, first of all, people had to rely on existing partnerships. It wasn't a time to really forge new partnerships with people, and if you didn't already have one in place, it was difficult. And that, I think the senior and people with disabilities was a group that came up repeatedly as a group of unfamiliar, people were unfamiliar with how to work with them, and it was difficult to figure out where that population was, a clearly vulnerable population that needed vaccine, and it was much later in the game that they were able to finally get vaccine to those groups. The second, sort of probably a more overarching issue that came into play was that people were unable to focus on underserved. We had an emergency response trying to get to priority groups. People had limited staff capacity, so trying to focus on groups that extended beyond the traditional, the priority groups was difficult. People didn't have the resources to do it, and they had to do it much later on. Again, unfamiliar with contract nurses, people had some concerns about hiring out people that they didn't know if were familiar, how familiar they were with vaccine storage and handling. So trying to figure out who it is that they felt were a trusted vaccination resource, and then limited bilingual staff. So the successes that I want to go back over are the existing partnerships. Again, people were able to team up with individuals and community groups, and they did this quickly. Again, reminding all of us that the plan had been to do mass vax clinics, and instead they had to turn around and figure out how to partner with people to get vaccine out into different settings. So the adaptive strategies that people came up with to redirect their efforts toward doing a provider-centered delivery of vaccine, which again was great, was facilitated by the state, but the agencies really had to come up with how in fact to make that and to meet public demand and explain to the public that those demands. Committed staff and volunteers clearly came up all the time, use of volunteers through nursing schools and pharmaceutical schools. And then improved public trust through consistent messaging and transparency. Again, I think local agencies felt they had actually been very successful in engaging the public in discussions about priority groups, the meaning of those priority groups, the availability of vaccine, and the multiple ways that they got those messages across to the public through internet postings, through having phone lines with information, and using the use of local resources like radio and television to get the messages out to the public. And the public response, by and large, was pretty positive. Of course, there were frustrations with not being able to get vaccine, but the fact that they tried so hard to be transparent about it was a success from their perspective. The recommendations that came out of our study, some of them are, the first was to develop mass vaccination plans for varied vaccine supply. So clearly the scenario is not always going to be that you're going to have enough vaccine to do mass clinics, so you need to come up with other strategies, and this is a good experience to figure out what those strategies might look like. Fostering interagency partnerships, again, the idea that they had an opportunity to exercise or to understand where the gaps were in their partnership abilities, and so to figure out where those gaps were and to start to build on those so that they know in future response scenarios they would be able to rely on different people to reach the populations that they maybe had to postpone until later on. Enhancing strategies for reaching underserved populations at an earlier point in time. So they understood now, again, they've had the opportunity to practice what it is to get vaccine out to these underserved populations, perhaps engaging in those a little bit earlier. As people said, they had to think about these later on. Maybe they could move that up in conjunction with doing priority group servicing. Prioritization decisions, clearly it was not a very popular decision to wait until the middle of December to open up vaccination, and the idea that this should be based on the fact that if most agencies had reached their priority groups, it was time to open up those priority groups earlier. That was the comment that came back from agencies repeatedly. And also to allow interagency transfer of vaccines, so to let people exchange and share resources where if somebody was having a difficult time getting enough vaccine out to reach even the basic priority groups. And I don't have a conclusion slide, but I think the timing of the study was really essential. We got this for, it largely felt like people, this was the first time people had the opportunity to take pause and think about what they had actually done and accomplished in such a short time frame, and they were able to walk through step by step what they had in fact implemented, what were the barriers. And it was, as people were talking, in my experience, as people were discussing, walking through what they had accomplished, it seemed like they were actually surprised at how positive their response was to what they had accomplished. I think people had come into the conversation thinking that there would be a lot of negatives, and I think they came out of it with a lot of positive because they realized what they had achieved with very limited staff. For most people, there were no additional staff to add on to their core staff. So I think the experience was really positive. We were able to, this was the first time that they were being debriefed. Additional evaluations followed ours. And so we were able to both inform additional preparedness evaluations that went on, but also gave them the chance to really think about what went well and what hadn't gone well. So I think overall it was a really positive experience, and I think that we came out with some good recommendations as a result of having done this evaluation. Thank you.